A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it started in a very Daniel way. He went down a stationary rabbit hole for his home inventory system, discovered the world of isographic pens, and then found out Hannah, his architect wife, actually owns one. His question is basically, what physical writing tools still have currency in architecture, and does their persistence come from practical necessity, or from something deeper? Something about the clarity you get on paper that you can't replicate digitally, even with a graphics tablet. I have to say, watching him discover this world was like watching someone find out vinyl records aren't just decorative wall art.
It's a great question because it cuts right through the assumption most of us carry around. The assumption is that CID killed the drafting table sometime in the 90s and nobody looked back. But the reality is way more interesting. You walk into a working architecture studio in 2026, even a tech-forward firm running the latest version of Revit, and you will find physical drafting tools. Not as museum pieces, as things people actually use.
I think that's the part that surprised Daniel most. He assumed the isographic pen was extinct, and then there it was in his own house, in his wife's toolkit, still in rotation.
The isographic pen is the perfect entry point for this conversation because it is such a specific, purpose-built instrument. The Rotring Isograph was introduced in 1963 and it is still in production as of 2026 with almost no design changes. That alone tells you something. Nobody keeps making a tool for 63 years unless it solves a real problem.
Break this down for me. What is an isographic pen actually doing that a regular pen cannot?
Okay, so mechanically, it is completely different from a fountain pen or a rollerball. The isograph uses a tubular nib. Inside that tube is a very fine wire that acts as a regulator. Ink flows down via capillary action and gravity, and the wire prevents the ink from just gushing out. What you get is a line of absolutely consistent width regardless of the angle you hold the pen at, regardless of the pressure you apply, regardless of the direction you are drawing. You can draw vertically upward, you can draw at 45 degrees, you can draw on a surface that is tilted. The line width does not change.
It is the precision that matters. Consistent line weight.
In technical drawing, line weight is meaning. A thick line means something different from a thin line. A 0.25 millimeter line communicates something specific about the edge of a material, the cut line of a wall, the profile of a structural element. A 0.7 millimeter line communicates something else entirely. If your line weight varies because you pressed a little harder at the end of a stroke, you have introduced ambiguity into a drawing where ambiguity is expensive.
A fountain pen cannot do this because the nib flexes and the ink flow depends on angle and pressure.
A fountain pen is a writing instrument designed for expressive variation. An isographic pen is a drafting instrument designed to eliminate variation. They look similar, they both use ink, but they are solving fundamentally different problems. The misconception that they are the same thing is one of those little errors that drives architects quietly insane.
Of course there are.
There are dozens of us.
We have established the isograph is mechanically fascinating, but the more interesting question is, why does a tool from 1963 still have a place in a 2026 architecture studio? Let us talk about the cognitive science behind that.
This is where it gets genuinely interesting. There was a study published in 2024 in the Journal of Engineering Design, Volume 35, Issue 2, that looked at this directly. They had architects produce design iterations using physical sketching versus digital sketching tools. The architects using physical tools produced 23% more design iterations in the same time period, and independent judges rated those iterations as more creative. This is not nostalgia producing warm feelings. This is measurable output.
23% more iterations is a lot. That is not a marginal gain. That is a significant difference in productivity.
It is enormous. And the researchers pointed to a few factors. One is what they called the cognitive overhead of software interfaces. When you are sketching in CAD or even in a digital sketching app, the software is constantly asking you to make decisions. What layer is this on? What line weight? What object type? Before you have even figured out what the thing is, the software is demanding that you categorize it.
The tool is forcing premature decisions. It is asking you to be specific before you are ready to be specific.
That is exactly it. And there is a name for this in design theory. Donald Schoen, in his book The Reflective Practitioner from 1983, introduced the concept of reflection in action. The idea is that designers think through their hands. The act of drawing is not just recording a thought that already exists in your head. The act of drawing is the thinking. The line goes down, you look at it, it suggests something, you respond with another line, and the design emerges through that conversation between hand, eye, and paper.
Digital tools insert a layer of interface between the hand and the mark. They break the conversation.
Not always, and not for every phase of work, but in the early conceptual phase, that interruption is costly. When you are sketching by hand, you could draw a vague squiggle that means building mass here, maybe, and the vagueness is productive. It leaves room for the idea to evolve. In CID, you cannot draw a vague squiggle. You have to draw a specific rectangle with specific dimensions on a specific layer. The tool forces precision before you have clarity.
It is like being asked to name your child before you have even decided if you want children.
That is a very corn way to put it, but yes. And this connects to something the prompt mentioned. Daniel said he has started wireframing technical ideas by hand, and there is something unusually delightful about the process. That delight is not just aesthetic. It is the feeling of cognitive friction being reduced. Your brain is not fighting the tool. It is working with the tool.
I think there is also something about the physical constraints being generative rather than limiting. When you cannot undo, when you cannot zoom, when you cannot copy and paste, you have to commit. Each mark is deliberate. And that deliberateness, counterintuitively, speeds things up, because you are not spending 10 minutes nudging a rectangle 3 pixels to the left.
There is a name for this too, the generative constraint theory. Physical tools impose constraints that actually enhance creativity by forcing deliberate decisions. You cannot endlessly tweak, so you move forward. You cannot zoom in to obsess over a detail, so you stay at the right level of abstraction for the phase you are in. The constraint is the feature.
Let us broaden this out. The isograph is one tool. What else is still in the architect's physical toolkit?
The parallel rule is the big one. This is a horizontal straight edge that rides on cables or a track system attached to a drafting board. It maintains perfect horizontal alignment across the entire drawing surface. You can slide it up and down, and wherever it stops, you have a guaranteed horizontal line. Combine that with a triangle, and you can produce any angle you need.
This is still used even in firms that use BIM software like Revit for construction documents.
In the schematic design phase, when you are rapidly exploring massing and spatial relationships, a parallel rule and a roll of trace paper is often faster than any digital tool. You can sketch a floor plan, lay trace paper over it, sketch a variation, lay another sheet, sketch another variation. In 5 minutes, you have 5 options. In CID, setting up 5 options might take you an hour.
The trace paper workflow is something I have seen Hannah do. It is almost like a physical version of version control. Each sheet is a branch.
That is a great analogy. And the physical stacking of trace sheets gives you a spatial relationship between versions that a digital file history does not. You can hold 2 versions up to the light and see the differences simultaneously. You can spread 5 versions across the desk and compare them all at once. The physical arrangement of paper on a surface is a kind of spatial thinking that screens do not support well.
What about the other tools? The ones that sound almost comically specific?
The erasing shield. This is a thin metal or plastic stencil with various shaped cutouts. You place it over your drawing, and it protects the lines you want to keep while allowing you to erase a specific area. In the ink on Mylar era, this was essential because erasing ink from plastic film was unforgiving. The erasing shield is still in production and still in use.
It is a tool whose entire purpose is to let you make a mistake in a controlled way.
And that is actually profound if you think about it. The erasing shield acknowledges that mistakes will happen and gives you a precise way to correct them without damaging the work around them. Compare that to the undo command, which is a blunt instrument. Undo erases everything back to a checkpoint. The erasing shield lets you surgically remove one error while preserving the context.
That is a metaphor for something, but I am not sure what.
We will find it by the end of the episode. Other tools include the drafting brush, which is exactly what it sounds like, a soft brush for sweeping eraser crumbs off the drawing without smudging. Adjustable triangles that can be set to any angle. Compasses of various sizes for circles and arcs. The beam compass for very large radii. French curves for irregular curves. All of these are still manufactured and sold.
The interesting thing is that none of these tools have changed substantially in decades. The parallel rule you buy today is functionally identical to one from 1955. The isograph is the same mechanism Rotring introduced in 1963. These are mature tools. They reached their final form a long time ago.
Which is itself a fascinating contrast with digital tools that are constantly updating, constantly changing their interface, constantly adding features. The stability of the physical tool is a feature. You learn it once, and it works the same way for your entire career. There is no learning curve for the new version of the parallel rule because there is no new version of the parallel rule.
We have talked about the what and the how. Now let us talk about the so what. What does this mean for the way we think about tools and knowledge work more broadly?
One of the most striking data points I found comes from a 2025 survey by the American Institute of Architects. 62% of architects under 35 own a physical drafting kit. Compare that to architects over 50, where the number is 48%. The digital natives are more likely to own analog drafting tools than the generation that actually trained on them.
That is counterintuitive. You would expect the younger architects to be fully digital.
And the survey asked why. The top answers were not nostalgia. There were screen fatigue and the need for a different mode of thinking. Architects spend 8 to 10 hours a day in front of screens. Hand drawing provides a cognitive reset. It is a different kind of mental activity that feels restorative.
I think this connects to the broader slow productivity movement. Cal Newport's book, Slow Productivity, from 2024, talks about knowledge workers rediscovering the value of low-throughput, high-quality work. The drafting table is a physical manifestation of that philosophy. You sit down, you work on one thing, you cannot check email, you cannot get notifications, you are just there with the paper and the pen.
There is a materiality aspect that matters more than we usually acknowledge. Paper has texture, weight, absorbency. Different papers take ink differently. Vellum has a different feel from Bristol board. The physical properties of the material shape the thinking process. Anthropologists call this material thinking, the idea that cognition is not just happening in your brain. It is distributed across your brain, your hands, your tools, and your materials.
Digital surfaces are uniform. A pixel is a pixel. There is no grain direction, no tooth, no absorbency. You cannot choose a rougher paper because you want the line to feel different.
That uniformity is efficient in many ways, but it also eliminates what you might call happy accidents. The slight bleed of ink into paper fibers, the way a pencil line varies with the texture of the surface, the way a wash of watercolor pools unpredictably. These material behaviors can be productive. They introduce variation that the designer responds to, and that response can lead somewhere unexpected and interesting.
The glitch as creative input.
And digital tools are designed to eliminate glitches. The whole point of CAD is predictability and precision. But in the early design phase, predictability can be a liability. You want the medium to push back a little. You want it to surprise you.
Let me bring in a concrete example here. The Renzo Piano Building Workshop. They are famous for this. They produce hundreds of hand-drawn studies for every project before anything touches CID.
Renzo Piano's team is one of the most prominent examples of a sketch-first culture in high-end architecture. And this is not a small boutique firm. They design major institutional buildings, museums, airports. The hand drawings are not decorative. They are the primary design exploration tool. The CID work comes later, once the concept is resolved.
Another example is BIG, Bjork Ingels Group. They have a sketch-first culture too. Every project starts with hand-drawn diagrams, and those diagrams are scanned and become the foundation for the digital models. They deliberately preserve the hand-drawn quality in their presentations. The diagram is the argument, and the hand-drawn quality communicates that this is a human idea, not a machine output.
Which brings us to something the prop touched on, Daniel mentioned that hand drawing gives a sense of clarity you cannot get digitally. I think part of that clarity comes from the fact that a hand-drawn line communicates human presence. A vector path is perfect and anonymous. A hand-drawn line has micro-variations that your brain reads as evidence of a human making a decision.
I said something like this once before. The hand-drawn line carries the weight of a human choice. You can see the moment the pen touched the paper, the moment it lifted. You can see the slight hesitation at a corner. All of that is information about the design process.
It is information that CID strips out. A CID line is perfect, but it is also dead in a certain sense. It does not tell you anything about how it got there or how certain the designer was about it.
Let us talk about the practical side. If someone listening to this is thinking, I want to try this. I want to see if hand drawing changes how I think about my own work. What should they actually buy and how should they use it?
Get a single isographic pen, 0.3 or 0.5 millimeter. Rotring is the standard, about $30 to $40, and it will last decades if you maintain it properly. Get a pad of smooth, heavy paper, something like a Bristol pad or a marker paper pad. Do not use cheap printer paper. The paper quality matters because the tactile experience matters.
What should they draw?
Whatever they are working on. If you are a software architect, sketch your system architecture. If you are a UX designer, sketch screen flows. If you are an engineer, sketch mechanism diagrams. The key is to spend 15 minutes a day with no digital tools allowed. No undo, no zoom, no layers. Just you, the pen, and the paper.
The constraint is the point. You cannot erase, so you have to think before you draw. You cannot zoom, so you have to stay at the right level of abstraction. You cannot copy and paste, so you have to draw each element deliberately.
After a week, reflect on whether the process changed your thinking. Did you notice different things about the problem? Did you make connections you might have missed? Did the physical act of drawing slow you down in a useful way?
I have been doing this myself, actually, since Daniel started talking about it. I have been wireframing some ideas by hand, and the thing I noticed is that drawing forces me to think about structure before detail. When I am working digitally, I tend to jump straight to refining things. With the pen, I have to get the big relationships right first because changing them later is hard, and that turns out to be exactly the right order of operations for good design.
That is the generative constraint in action. The tool's limitations are guiding you toward better process.
It is like the tool is smarter than I am, but in a very stupid way.
The tool is not smarter. It is just aligned with how your brain actually works. Your brain wants to think about spatial relationships first and details second. The isograph lets you do that. CID wants you to think about details first because it needs to know what everything is before it can draw it.
This brings us to a bigger question. The isographic pen is a tool that does one thing extremely well and does not pretend to do anything else. That is an interesting design philosophy.
Specialization beats generalization in certain contexts. The isograph produces a consistent line width at any angle with zero latency. That is all it does, and it does it perfectly. A graphics tablet can do 1,000 things reasonably well, but it cannot match the isograph on that one specific task. There is a lesson there about tool design in general.
The zero latency point is worth dwelling on. Even the best graphics tablets have latency. The Wacom Cintiq Pro, released in 2022, has about 2 milliseconds of latency. That is very fast, but the human brain can detect micro delays in the 5 to 10 millisecond range. The isograph has zero latency by definition. The mark appears the instant the nib touches the paper. There is no signal processing, no display refresh, no pipeline.
Latency matters for the same reason cognitive overhead matters. It breaks the feedback loop between hand and eye. When you are drawing, you are engaged in a tight sensory motor loop. You move your hand, you see the mark, you adjust your hand based on what you see the new mark, and so on. Any delay in that loop, even a very small one, degrades the quality of the interaction.
It is the difference between playing a musical instrument and triggering a sample. The sample might sound perfect, but the musician cannot play expressively through a delayed interface.
That is a perfect analogy. And architects, when they are sketching, are playing expressively. They are not just recording decisions, they are discovering decisions through the physical act of drawing. The latency matters because it interrupts that discovery process.
Let us go back to the original question. Does the persistence of these tools speak more to practical need, or to something deeper about the clarity of working on paper?
I think the answer is both, and they are connected. The practical need is real. The isographic pen does something that digital tools cannot fully replicate. The parallel rule enables a rapid iteration workflow that C80 cannot match in the early design phase. But those practical advantages exist because of the deeper thing. The deeper thing is that human cognition is embodied. We think with our hands. The physical properties of tools and materials shape the thinking process in ways that digital interfaces have not yet captured.
I would add that the persistence is not about rejecting digital tools. Nobody is arguing that architects should go back to hand-drafting construction documents. That would be absurd. The argument is that different phases of design benefit from different tools, and the optimal toolkit includes both analog and digital.
The firms we have mentioned, Renzo Piano, BIG, they are not anti-technology. They use the most advanced BIM software available. They just use it at the right phase. Hand drawing for schematic design and conceptual exploration, digital tools for development and documentation. The hybrid workflow is the sophisticated position.
The either framing is a false choice. It is not CID versus hand drawing. It is CID and hand drawing, each doing what it does best.
That is a useful principle for knowledge work in general. Do not ask which tool is better. Ask which tool is better for this specific phase of this specific kind of work. The answer might be different at different times, and that is fine.
Before we wrap up, I want to touch on the future. AI-assisted design tools are becoming more prevalent. Autodesk Forma, released in 2024, can generate building massing options from text prompts. As these tools get better, will hand drawing become less relevant or more relevant?
I think it becomes more relevant, counterintuitively. As AI-generated design options become more common, the ability to quickly sketch and evaluate ideas by hand becomes a competitive advantage. The architect who can rapidly iterate by hand can explore more possibilities before committing to a digital model. And the hand-drawn sketch serves as a kind of human signature. It says, a person made these choices, not a machine.
There is also the question of hybrid tools. The remarkable tablet, the iPad Pro with a paper-like screen protector. These are attempts to give you the haptic feedback of paper with the flexibility of digital. But none of them have fully replicated the isograph experience.
They have not. The remarkable is excellent for note-taking and reading, but it does not have the precision or the specific tactile qualities of a technical pen on drafting paper. The quest for a true digital isograph continues. And I think it is telling that as of 2026, nobody has cracked it. The physical tool remains the gold standard for that specific experience.
Which brings us to the final thought. The survival of the isographic pen is not a story about nostalgia or ludism. It is a story about the irreducibility of certain cognitive processes to digital workflows. Some kinds of thinking require physical engagement with physical materials. That is not a limitation to be overcome. It is a feature of how human cognition works.
I think that is what Daniel was sensing when he described the unusual delight of wireframing by hand. He was experiencing his brain working the way it evolved to work, in physical space, with physical tools, through physical movement. The delight is not sentimental. It is neurological.
The hand knows things the screen does not.
That is going on a t-shirt.
It is already on a t-shirt.
Of course you did.
All right, let us get practical for listeners who want to try this. Buy one Rotring isograph, 0.3 or 0.5 millimeter. Get a pad of smooth, heavy paper. Spend 15 minutes a day sketching something you are working on. No digital tools. After a week, ask yourself if your thinking changed. I am willing to bet it will.
If you want to go deeper, the parallel rule principle applies to any kind of structured thinking. Create an environment that maintains alignment without requiring active effort. For a software architect, that might mean a whiteboard with a permanent grid. For a writer, it might mean a notebook with dot grid paper. The tool should reduce cognitive overhead, not add to it.
The isograph is also just a beautiful object. There is something satisfying about using a tool that was designed in 1963 and still works exactly as intended. It is the opposite of planned obsolescence. It is planned permanence.
That permanence is itself a kind of resistance to the churn of digital tools. Your isograph will not require a software update. It will not change its interface. It will not be discontinued because the company pivoted to a subscription model. It will just keep making consistent lines until you lose it or break it, which is unlikely because it is built like a tiny surgical instrument.
I think that reliability is part of the cognitive benefit. You trust the tool completely, so you do not think about the tool at all. You just think about the work.
That is the highest compliment you can pay a tool. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1986, Russian scientists drilling through nearly 4 kilometers of ice above Lake Vostok discovered that the subglacial lake's water contains approximately 50 times more oxygen than typical freshwater, dissolved under extreme pressure in a concentration so high that any organism living there would essentially be breathing a toxic atmosphere by surface standards.
The lake is trying to kill things by being too oxygenated. That is a new one.
That is unsettling.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtob, and thanks to Daniel for the prompt that sent us down this very satisfying rabbit hole. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more than you know.
Find us at myweirdprompts.com. We will be back soon with more questions you did not know you needed answered.
Until then, draw something by hand. See what happens.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.